It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
The Legacy, a memoir, one family's role in Britain's cover-ups. Jean Barr opens the antique chest she inherited from her great-great-uncle Alexander and unravels the strands of his life as an evangelical Presbyterian minister in late 19th century Italy, unpacking the cover-ups of Britain's history of empire. Fascinating subject, fascinating book. Delighted to be joining me live on the line to give me a little more information about The Legacy is the author Jean Barr. Good morning to you, Jean.
Hi, Giles. Nice to meet you. Thanks for inviting me on.
The pleasure is all mine. Explain a little bit about this antique chest then. Was it just literally a situation where you thought, I'll have a look at this? Or did somebody say, you know, you really ought to see what's in this? How did it all come about? How did it begin?
Well, I had known the chest since being a child, and it always fascinated me because I knew it came from a Presbyterian minister who lived in Italy, and I love Italy. And I knew nothing at all about him, but I was always really puzzled. Why would a Presbyterian minister from whom I inherited this wonderful Venetian chest, why would he go and live all of his life in a Catholic country? So I began to try to find out why this was the case. And the chest I adored because it had a secret compartment in it. And it wasn't really secret because it was just a little box within the box. And I used to treat it as my secret place.
Right.
So what nobody in my family discovered was that the chest also represented something much deeper, a much, much deeper secret, and that it was actually a chain in a very long part of it. It was a wee link in a chain that linked my family to the very heart of Britain's most shameful history, which was slavery, as I discovered. But what began to happen was I saw a television program which was about Queen Elizabeth's chief minister, Robert Cecil. Well, it was actually William Cecil to begin with, then his son. And the television programs were about spying. And I suddenly realized that the family history tree that I was developing around Alexander, the uncle from whom I inherited the chest, there was a name in that family tree which connected to Alexander, the Presbyterian minister,
right,
which was the name coming up in this television program, which was Robert Cecil. And then suddenly on my family tree, other names kept springing up who were part of Britain's aristocracy. So it was a great puzzle, and I had to try and unravel why this was the case. Why were all of these illustrious people, about whom I knew nothing, why were they connecting to my uncle Alexander? So that took me into unpacking a story which actually brought to light the ways in which a handful of families can shore up their wealth. And I started to pursue a different quest, which was, I say in the book, following the money, which is what I did. So just beginning to trace Alexander's life was simple because he was a working class boy, grew up in Edinburgh, was what's known as a kind of lad of pairts in Scotland, is that, you know, the working class boy who makes good, gets a good education. But that was the simplest part of it. He trained in the ministry and started as a minister in Orkney. Then, because of his wife's bad health, they moved to San Remo, where he became a minister there. But she soon died, and he took his second wife, whose name was Julia Braddon, who was a widow. And she was the one who connected Alexander to some of the richest and most powerful families in Britain. And these families, some of them, had made their fortune through owning slave-driven sugar plantations in the Caribbean. So that was the first clue. That was what I had to then chart. How come the Cecil link to this and money? And it did become just tracing all these amazing connections. And that's how the book came about. I wouldn't have just written a book about my uncle, I don't think, because I'm not terribly interested in family history, but I am interested in how it is that some of the factors which affect us most strongly are often the most difficult to see in our own lives. So it was a lot of revelations about my own family, which were astonishing to me.
And I suppose one of the things is the fact that, as you say, it seems to be this nucleus of families, this small group of families who, during the decades, during the centuries even, sort of maintain their grip on influence and power and wealth.
Exactly. And this is what really fascinated me. And it took me to places I would never have dreamt going. I discovered this wonderful University College of London's Legacies of British Slave Ownership database, which showed that the richest slave owners also, at the time of emancipation, made another huge amount of money. Because there was a thing called the compensation scheme for slave owners, which was a condition of ending emancipation, because they were a very powerful lobby in Parliament as well. And they received a massive government bailout in 1834, which amounts, it was 20 million at the time, but amounted to about £17 billion today. But in terms of government, the percentage of government expenditure at the time was 40% of government expenditure, which would be equivalent now to £200 billion. And I discovered that debt was not paid off by the British taxpayer until 2015. Which is an astonishing fact.
Indeed.
And it resulted in further concentrating wealth in the hands of a very few, very rich families. And, of course, the slaves received absolutely nothing. And by making this grant out, it kind of money laundered the fact that the money came from slavery. And this was intensified by the fact that a lot of the people who made money around about that time bought land, which was another way of legitimizing the source of the money. It's an extraordinary story. And I then linked it to the Highland clearances. A lot of land was bought in the Highlands, West Highlands especially, in the 1830s mainly. There were many, many families who received money. It's a complicated story, but aristocratic families were losing land. This money was a kind of injection into that, and a lot of the marriages into the aristocracy occurred round about that time, and that's where the answer lay. That's why Julia, Alexander's second wife, was related to many, many aristocratic families going back in time. So it was a way of perpetuating them.
It's certainly, I mean, you talk about this, you know, the unexpected twists and changes and plot links, if you like, to what is simply a rather nice Venetian chest. I mean, we've already been through the plantations, slavery, and I certainly expect to have the Highland clearances coming up on this one as well.
No, it's fascinating because I think family history really does draw quite a lot of scorn from academic historians. But for me, it's been an astonishing journey because it has made me look into my own family as well in the north of Scotland, who were farmers. And I always assumed that they were poor crofters, but I discovered that they were anything but.
Yeah, but that's part. You see, this is the wonderful thing about social history, family history, because it provides colour, if you like. It puts meat on the bone of, because we all have, we know the strategic, the grand strategy, we know the politics, we know the proclamations, but it's the personal. And as you say, we can have those preconceived ideas of, if you come from the north of Scotland, you're obviously a poor crofter, you're eking out a life up there. But the actual reality you can discover through a social history, more so than just perhaps just a dusty textbook.
Exactly. And it also led me into thinking very much about inheritance and how it is that wealth keeps perpetuating itself. And I then managed to connect what was going on with my family in the north of Scotland with the enclosure system in Britain, and began reading a lot about land, housing. I'd discovered that land prices increased around fivefold between the 1990s and now, which is extraordinary. And that links to the high cost in housing now, which also links, I think, to hoarding land until buying land and keeping it until its price rises so that you get more profit from it. Mm. So it took me into a whole range of economics, new economics, and linking the housing crisis in Britain to the price of land. It's quite a simple equation. And I was astonished to discover how few families own how much land, particularly in places like London, where housing is extraordinarily high. And some of these families, you can trace it back to the money they made from slavery.
Mm.
The saying goes,
buy land because they're not making it anymore.
Exactly.
And it's interesting you say about chilling, because if you sort of watch television or, you know, satellite TV, we always get these discover your family history, and it's all sort of warm and slightly like a large comfort blanket. But of course, when you look at family history, they're as fallible and as many foibles as we do ourselves. So it can be sort of disconcerting to find out that your family were involved in, and perhaps that your ancestors aren't this sort of the benevolent, all-seeing and incredibly wise individuals that you think they are in your mind.
Exactly. And it was interesting, the connection between Alexander's Protestantism and the growth of wealth. His wife belonged to a very strange Protestant sect called Moravians, and her family sent the first Christian missionaries to Jamaica to Christianize, i.e. civilize, the slaves. So it's that kind of collusion between money and religion, which again is fascinating.
I'm just intrigued about how he ended up in Venice as well, because presumably Venice had been civilized before Alexander turned up. So how does a Presbyterian minister end up in the hotbed of was it Venice, or was it just Italy in general?
It was first of all San Remo, and that was the health of his wife. She had TB, and then she died, and he was actually, he had to find a job, and he had remarried by then, went to Venice with his new wife, because he got work then with the Church of Scotland. And I, who knew there were missionaries?
I'm just this vision of the vision of these, the Church of Scotland arriving and tutting everywhere. Going,
it's, you know, extraordinary.
Tutting furiously.
It's so amazing. And he'd had a house where he, first of all, he had used an American church to have sermons. He had a huge congregation. He knew people like Gladstone, Chamberlain, a huge number of them. And even the poet, his name's gone out of my head now, who was a fascist sympathiser. It's just gone out of my head.
Ezra
totally.
Pound? No,
Ezra Pound, thank you so much.
No problem.
It's the nerves.
I get, don't worry, I get them too, yes. Anyway.
Ian helped him to produce his first book of poetry in Venice. So he was part of this cosmopolitan grouping, which is fascinating. But what I find with family history, it's the family narrative together with its cross-national history that should be the most illuminating, I think, because David Olusoga, who's one of my heroes, his view of family history is it is world history. And that's what I've discovered through looking at my family and a little obscure corner of my family history. It's quite astonishing.
Indeed. Now, tell me, it says in the notes, it says he became a cheerleader for a dictator. Now, just that piques my interest. So how does a Presbyterian manager get involved with the idea of dictatorship? And tell me a little more about that.
Well, I think Clink Alexander was a bit of a hero worshipper. And he had some benign heroes, like Ruskin, who was one of his heroes. He wrote about art as well and followed Ruskin's way of writing about Venice. But when his wife died, he, I think, transferred his affections to Mussolini, whom he met and about whom he wrote a book. And it's a very adulatory kind of text about Mussolini. I don't understand it. I think if she had lived, she wouldn't have been taken in by his posturings. And it's something to do with Mussolini's appeal, I mean, as an orator, and he wanted to bring back the kind of medieval charms of the way Venice was in the past, and Alexander identified with that, the cultural idea and aesthetic kind of whitewashing of the place. So it is a puzzle, but it's another fascinating one, which I'll go on trying to find out and get to the bottom of.
Absolutely incredible, the fact that you can open up this documents and suddenly you've got a link to Mussolini via Ezra Pound via Ruskin. Did you have any ink? And, you know, and as I said before, via plantation slavery in the Highland clearings. Did you have any inkling that you were about to go through this fascinating sort of journey, as it were? And I use that word not in a minute, but it really is.
None whatsoever. I mean, I thought I was just going to find out about a fairly exotic character who lived in Italy, and I'm an Italophile, so I thought I would see some lovely art. And of course, I went to Venice and San Remo, had a lovely trip, but I could never have guessed anything like this was turned up. It's just, it's astonishing.
And behind this sort of this roller coaster historical travelogue with a support, you know, a role of sort of a cameo parts from sort of well-known names. But there is a serious point, isn't there? Like you said, you mentioned land ownership, and there are, you know, you think about the Duke of Westminster in London, who's got this huge amount of land, and therefore whoever becomes Duke of Westminster in almost in perpetuity is going to be one of the most wealthy person in the UK, if not the, and the same applies everywhere, isn't it? So there's got to be, are you sort of literally bringing this into the light, as it were?
That's what it felt like. Yes, that's what it does feel like. But it was also revelatory to me. I was discovering things. I would never have guessed that so few people own so much land in our country. I mean, for instance, in Scotland, 500 people own 50% of its privately owned land. It's tiny numbers. And families who continue to shore up their wealth because of the land prices having increased so much. So a lot of money is now invested in the richest parts of London, and there are still people who can't buy houses. So there's a huge imbalance in the country, particularly Britain, I think, between homeowners and those who can't own a house.
And totally different. And you see, this is the thing. All those who say, I don't know why people study it, because I am, and I always tell my guests this, I am that worst kind of creature. I'm the armchair historian. But people say, you study history. You know, it's bunches of dead kings and robber barons and the whole thing. But no, because there is an absolute link between, like you're just describing in the personal history, between those, the slavery, the plantations, the clearances, Mussolini, Ezra Pound, Ruskin, the whole thing, and the current situation that people are finding in big urban centres where they can't afford, working class people cannot afford to live in the centre of urban centres.
Exactly.
And that is a social issue that's just pressing the current government.
And it's all interconnected. That's the point about it all. And the fact of land ownership is a secret, almost. It's very, very difficult to find out who owns what. But the studies that have been done have shown that it's still the traditional aristocratic families of Britain still have a stranglehold on a huge amount of property, which I would never have guessed. I thought it had all been much more dispersed. Mm. So these are things that and little tales within that as well, which are I tell in the book.
You see,
about people who are who become very politically powerful. So it's been fascinating.
That people talk about going down, the thing about the internet is people go down rabbit holes. Well, when I was younger and I had encyclopedia in my house, and I would go down rabbit holes.
Of course,
and
you did.
Of course we did. And we would go down rabbit holes left, right and center. And it sounds to me like you've gone down the best kind of rabbit hole and you're still going, because little bits and pieces crop up and you think, I'll just have a look at that. I'll just have a look at that.
Exactly. It will never end. It will never end.
If you had the proverbial time machine and you could spend 10 minutes, half an hour with Alexander, what do you think you'd say to him?
Why did you do it?
Why did you do it? That was quite a simple. I suppose. Which particular part do you think? Go to Venice, find yourself cheerleading for Mussolini, or just generally why you do it? Full stop.
I think it's that one. It's how could you? I mean, I assume he knew some of the background to his wife's money. And it was that money which enabled him to have the life he had in Venice and in San Remo as a writer, as a preacher. And there are so many contradictions in all of that. And if he had any inkling, how could he then write and praise and laud a man like Mussolini, who was a villain?
It's fabulous and fascinating. The book is called The Legacy, a Memoir, One Family's Role in Britain's Cover-Up. It's by Jean Barr, who we've been speaking to today. Jean, do you have a website? Do you do the social media thing? Can people find you online?
I don't do social media, I'm afraid.
That's probably a rabbit hole you're too far to go down. The book is called The Legacy, a Memoir, One Family's Role in Britain's Cover-Up. It's by Jean Barr. Jean, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. Bye-bye.